Welcome to Cybersecurity Where You Are, the Center for Internet Security's podcast. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO at CIS.
And I'm Tony Sager, Senior Vice President and Chief Evangelist at CIS. Cybersecurity affects us all, whether we're online at home, managing a company, supporting clients, or running a state or local government.
So join us on Wednesdays as we discuss trends and threats, explore security best practices, and interview experts in the industry.
Together, we'll clarify these issues, creating confidence in the connected world.
Hello, and welcome to the show, Cybersecurity Where You Are. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO here at the Center for Internet Security, joined by Anthony Esmaker, Regional Engagement Manager, and Randy Rose, VP of Security Operations and Intelligence. Anthony, Randy, welcome.
Thank you for having us, Sean. Appreciate it.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Absolutely. Thank you, Randy. Randy, what's this now? 7 episodes? It's got to be somewhere like that.
You know what? I lost count after, probably 5. I don't count anymore. I just,
You just turn up.
I'm just honorary co-host at this point.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Well, we're here today because we want to look at the acronym of SLTT. And I know you've both done some work, some presentation about this, and really what's hidden beneath those four letters. So, Randy, why don't we start off with you? And let's think about what the meaning behind SLTT. What does that mean to you? What does it mean to CIS and the operational program that's built around that?
All right. Yeah, I think what's really probably interesting for most people who, if anybody is following my career, not necessarily that that's a particularly fun thing to do, but people who know me from CIS or know me from my federal government days probably don't realize that I actually was a state employee here in New York. And one of my focus areas in New York was that I specifically, I did cybersecurity assessments, audits, penetration assessments, things like that for local governments and schools here in New York. So when I was going through that process, at the time when I got hired on by the state comptroller's office, I didn't really know a lot about local governments in New York. And I learned a tremendous amount about how they function in New York. And, in part, I actually was going through an academic program through a state university at the time and chose some classes that would teach me about local governments in New York. Because I noticed, I would go certain places. I'm like, well, this is really weird. Why do we do things differently in this county or this part of the state compared to, downstate by the city? So, I was always trying to learn these different things, and that gave me a really interesting, or I guess maybe not interesting, but I ended up developing an interest and a fascination with particularly New York State local government. And then, we're so close here in New England in the Northeast to New England, to Vermont and Massachusetts and Connecticut, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, that I started realizing there's all these nuance between Vermont and New York. Vermont, everything is a township for the most part, where in New York, everywhere you are, you're in a county. You might also be in a city, or you might be in a town. You can't be in both a town and a city at the same time, but that might not be the same in other states. And then, as I moved around the country, I lived in Virginia for a while, I lived in Wyoming, I lived in Texas. I realized, at the local government level, they do things differently all over the place. And so that's, really fascinating to me. And we use this acronym all the time, this SLTT acronym, but there's a lot to unpack. There's so much stuff hidden behind it that's not even just at the town, county, city level, but every taxpayer-funded organization. So you're talking public higher education, schools, public safety systems, parks and recreation, 911 call centers, libraries. So somebody that we work with here, Eugene, a coworker of mine here in operations, he reminds me of his favorite SLTT jurisdiction is a mosquito control district, which those are down in the Southeast in particular. A lot of them are coterminous with the counties. But there's so much stuff, kind of hidden behind that acronym that, we could probably do a whole season of podcast episodes just on this subject alone.
Awesome. Anthony, what about you? SLTT, what does it mean to you?
Yeah, it's funny, Sean, I haven't heard that term until I entered kind of the CIS cybersecurity CISA world as well, talking with my CISA colleagues and friends. And so SLTT, what it meant to me was my first full-time job. I started in local government. I started in one of the SLTCs not knowing it. And I spent 10 years working in local government in Michigan, both small, medium, and then working with the state as well on different initiatives. So I got to see kind of behind the scenes of what your city or town does, what your county does, what your state does. And it was just amazingly eye-opening. I always use the example, you know, you used to go to the park when you were a kid, and that was all you thought about, right? You didn't think about anything more than that. But then working in local government, you're like, oh, who cuts the grass? Who put the streetlight there? Who put the sign there? Who made that? Who, you know, put together the playscape? So, you know, all those questions you can get answers to. And it's just amazing how powerful state and local government is, and how much they do, and how dedicated the employees are that work for our SLTTs as well.
Absolutely. So some fun facts, and I'm pulling this from a presentation you guys had put together. Louisiana's civil law system is based on Napoleonic code. So, Randy, when we go into these elements, and you talked about the differences, and even neighboring states, completely different in terms of underlying structure. Ultimately, they're sharing only two things, electing a governor and have three branches. How does that complicate things when we're trying to maybe meet them where they are, except all 50 are in different areas and at different places? How do we necessarily adjust from a state perspective to operationalize and help states effectively?
Well, it's actually really interesting, too, because, you know, you mentioned Louisiana's civil law system. When I think of that, you know, the Napoleonic Code, I mean, it's like I picture the giant, you know, book, basically this massive book. The law is like in this, you know, this dusty old tome where, you know, everybody else is, you know, has these, you know, hopefully using more modern technology. I don't think, in my mind, I don't think Louisiana actually is pulling out this old book, but that's what I think of when I think of Napoleonic Code. Yeah. But Louisiana is a really good example of, there's this old adage that if you've seen one state, then you've only seen one state. And I think that's true. I mean, we have 50 states, all of the states, 46 of them are states by name, and four by name are considered commonwealths. But effectively, they're all, you know, states from a functioning perspective. But they all have their own unique government structure. They have their own laws. They have their own legislature. In some cases, you know, in New York State, there's four elected officials at the state level, where two of them are elected together. The governor and lieutenant governor are elected as a pair. Then you have the comptroller, who's independently elected, and you have the attorney general, who's independently elected. That's not necessarily the case in every other state. You know, they might have three elected officials or more. So, you know, I think from that perspective, especially from a cybersecurity delivery standpoint, you look across the 50 states, you have every state except for North Carolina has a chief information security officer at the state level. North Carolina has a chief risk officer. And the coverage that the chief risk officer has is actually broader than a chief information security officer. They also, you know, oversee the state's emergency management division. Those are the kinds of nuances that you have to think about when you're trying to deliver a model that says, hey, we want something that'll work for the 50 states. We don't want to necessarily create 50 models, but you have to have something that's at least flexible enough to appeal to and I guess bend to meet the needs of the 50 states, let alone the counties and you know, boroughs if you're in New Jersey, or parishes if you're in Louisiana, right? Effectively the same thing. A county and a parish and a borough are all the same, essentially the same thing. But if you go into Louisiana and start talking about counties, you know, they might look at you funny. So
it's funny you mentioned that, Randy, because I actually had a dusty old book at one of my jobs that had all the data stored in it, and it mentioned the one of the elections of Abraham Lincoln in it. So we're talking very old books. Pretty cool stuff. So, but Michigan's a great example of that too, Sean, where, you know, we have around 1,100 to 1,300 different election offices, different jurisdictions throughout the state, and everybody's doing something a little bit different. And certainly there's compliance and state law and regulations and national, but I think people assume when you say SLTT, they're talking within a regulated system, you know, by the federal government. This is how everybody does the same thing. And it's not. I mean, even in Michigan, you can go from one county to the next, and they're using different election equipment, different vendors completely. So your voting experience would be different. So that's a lot to consider from a cybersecurity perspective if you start thinking along those lines. If everybody's doing something a little bit different, not right or wrong, how do you approach that? Randy makes a good point. It has to be flexible, right?
Exactly. Exactly. So, Anthony, we'll move from the S in SLTT to L, local. Broad category, right? I mean, local encompasses schools, road, utilities, zoning, construction, social services, commerce. Now we've gone from, okay, so we've got 50 states, each one being different. Now we're moving into local, where there's such a nuance and a different application necessarily of certain conditions, controls, governance, compliance, things of that nature. How does that affect an approach when we're thinking about the local element?
Yeah, I think it affects the approach in the way that we have to understand that everybody has different resources and limitations. So, you know, I worked at a very, 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 very small township where you had no IT staff. And then I moved to a larger township, which had a whole IT and cyber team, you know, specifically software people even engaged there. So those are very different resources and experience. So it depends on whether you're leveraging a MSP or, you know, you have your own team or your own SOC maybe even. So we have to approach, you know, the L, the local, very differently than I think even maybe the state level, because you do have such large and small jurisdictions sharing the same acronym, if you will. So you have your city of Chicago, city of New York, you have, you know, your small townships, your hamlets, your other things that Randy mentioned. So how do you provide guidance and talk about compliance and be relevant in that conversation to the city of Chicago or the city of New York and also the small township at the same time? And I think sometimes in cybersecurity, that's where we fail, right? We talk about the best practice, period, you know, log analysis and having your own SOC if you can. And that's not reality for everybody. Some people don't even have access to, you know, working equipment, let alone an IT professional. So it's difficult, I think, Sean.
100%. Absolutely. Well, what we're going to do is we're going to take a quick commercial break. But before the break, to make sure you come back and are paying attention. Another fun fact, but a question. Which two states do not have counties? So let's take a break and we'll be right back. Are you a U.S. state, local, tribal, or territorial government organization? Well, if so, you know how remote and hybrid work models make it really difficult to protect your endpoints and manage your vulnerabilities? Well, this is where CIS Endpoint Security Services can help. Now available exclusively to U.S. SLTTs like yours, CIS ESS deploys directly on endpoint devices to help you identify, detect, respond to, and remediate endpoint security incidents and alerts. Now it works in partnership with our 24/7/365 CIS Security Operations Center, which analyzes threat detections and notifies you of actionable endpoint security incidents, all within 5 minutes. Now, ESS also comes with add-on and standalone capabilities that provide real-time insight into vulnerability and mobile devices, including those of subordinate organizations you oversee. So strengthen your endpoint defenses today by visiting cisecurity.org.
Thank you. And let's jump back into the episode.
Okay. Welcome back. The answer to our little trivia quiz, Connecticut and Rhode Island do not have counties. Very interesting. So, Randy, now coming back from the break, we've been through SL. We're now on to the first T, tribal. When we're thinking about tribal governments, we're talking about 574 tribal governments in the United States. Now, the way necessarily of governance and really understanding an ability to work with tribal, does that have an effect as well as, you know, we've talked state, local, we have to meet them where they are. Are there any nuances in that space when we're working with tribal governments?
Yeah, there's, you know, it's actually really interesting that there are 500 currently, well, at least as of the end of 2024, there were 574 federally recognized tribal governments in the U.S., which includes Alaskan Native entities. And, you know, when you think about that, you know, we were talking about how difficult it is to work with 50 unique state entities. By an order of 10, there are more tribal government entities. And when you're looking from a resource perspective, they are criminally underserved, right? Under-resourced organizations. A lot of them are in remote areas or difficult to get to. There's obviously, you know, a reasonably lack of trust between a lot of the government, the tribal government entities and the U.S. federal government. And so, you know, these organizations really operate as distinct, independent communities, political communities, and governmental communities with inherent sovereignty, that sovereignty that actually predates U.S. federal government law. And they effectively operate as with like a government-to-government relationship between tribal governments and between the tribal government itself and the federal government. So it's a really complex, it's not just complicated, but really like a spaghetti chart of complexity between, you know, what is available for these organizations, who can receive services, back to Anthony's point about local governments, you know, not having the resources to do a number of these things. There are some really unique challenges, I think, within the tribal government space. One of the things that I think is really interesting, which, you know, I don't want to get too far ahead of the fun fact there, but, you know, when you look at the federal government relationship with tribal American governments, the Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs is actually technically the oldest operational agency within the federal government. So it was founded in 1824. It's the oldest, kind of continuously running agency within the federal government. And so we have this long history of working with these organizations, and each one, you know, one of the other things that's kind of interesting about it is we talked about SLTT being this like grouping of entities all under one acronym. It's the same when you break them into their constituent parts. When we say local, we are talking about local governments as if they're all this, you know, the same kind of thing, but they're not. There's so much nuance to unpack behind the L alone. It's the same with tribal governments. In fact, there are a number of, you know, tribal organizations that don't particularly get along, right? And they see themselves or each other as adversarial. So, you know, it's a complex environment to operate within.
Yeah, you know, a good member story from that, Sean, is I was talking with one of our IT folks that was a member of an organization that supported a lot of different tribes in Alaska. You know, so you talk about a physical restart on a device or, you know, implementing something wirelessly or remotely. He's like, listen, I have some areas that aren't even on internet right now or are on stable internet. So for him, restarting a server, let's say a physical restart, would be getting on an airplane and flying to that location and trucking through that. So that's a little different than my experience. And I think we need to be aware of that again, especially, you know, coming from CIS and the MSISEC, when we have controls, we have benchmarks and suggestions and best practices. We need to be aware that our SLTTs are having a varied experience across the nation.
Absolutely.
And think about, you know, within those tribal organizations, they're running all of the services that, you know, you might expect in any other, you know, nested government organization. So they have healthcare services, right? They have water and wastewater treatment. They all those things that we rely on from a civil service perspective, public health related, law enforcement, all these things. And so when they're in a remote area, like Anthony was just talking about, and let's say a health system within the tribal government is impacted, and it's, you know, in a remote area that's difficult to get to out in Alaska or out in the middle of, you know, in some cases, you know, High Plains Desert or something like that. Think about how much more difficult it is to provide services, on-site services to support those organizations. It's not the same as being able to remote in to systems that are readily available and you have IT support on staff to help you, you know, collect evidence remotely and get to those answers really quickly. You know, you're talking about a significant time delay or dwell time just to get services back online. That can have real world impact to individuals that need medical services or need access to clean water, or need access to electricity, things like that. So, I mean, it's really it's a different kind of problem to solve. And I think that's one of the big challenges for a lot of organizations. When we talk about underserved organizations, the question isn't just, well, how do we do better at serving them? But it's really a logistics question, right? It's how do we do this in a way that is sensitive to, you know, their unique needs, and we're able to approach it with coming at it not just from a cybersecurity perspective, we're just trying to sell something or offer something, shove some service down their throats, but really coming at it from an empathetic view. You know, what are the things that are unique to your, you know, situation, to where you live, to the services that you provide, and how can we best service you? So it's really a lot more about active listening and, you know, meeting them where they are. It's, you know, cybersecurity where you are, but like meeting them truly where they are, right? And on their journey, and it's not just a cybersecurity journey, but you know, this whole kind of social journey that they're on, right? As an organization. So
now let's pull on that thread a little bit more if we could, Randy, because I think it's so important that it's when we think operational capacity as well as membership relation, understanding that is not just something that you pick up one day and say, oh, we now understand all these different nuances. I think it's experience and time. And as you mentioned, active listening, all of these approaches that we've taken in order to understand where they are so that necessarily we can help them to the best of our ability. That is not something that I would consider transferable. I think that's a learned environment. And obviously, you know, over the last 20 years, been learning how to work with SLTTs at where they are and being able to do these things that representatively are not just, we provide services to tribal. It has a completely different contextual element. And I think that's so important that needs to be emphasized in some ways, Randy, that this is an approach that necessarily they're not just a number, right? You know, a customer ID in a database. It's actually relationships that have been built over time that we can help and necessarily affect proper change and ultimately risk reduction, cybersecurity capability and awareness. That's not just something that happened overnight.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, we talk a lot about, or we have historically talked about the community model of self-defense and, you know, community model of cybersecurity defense. And it really is. I mean, it's exactly that. It's you don't build a community overnight. You know, it takes a long time to build trust, to develop relationships, to be present, right? And, you know, to have to be a more than just a, you know, an email away, but being a person that somebody knows they can call upon and trust, and you're going to be there for them. And, you know, we've really built that over time, I think, with a lot of our members. We have some, you know, we've had members going back, you know, all the way to the beginning that are still members because, and it's in some cases, they're still the same people, right, that were, you know, original members or in the early days of being MSISAC members. That have maintained that relationship, and I would say, you know, they're in many ways it's like a close personal relationship with people that are here at CIS, and whether they're on the MSISAC side or not, and those people who are receiving services, and in many cases, those members from the early days are providing further services and support to other members. You know, we have the mentorship program, we have, you know, we're building Member Connect right now where people can have more real time. Interactions with each other, because we know that, you know, the community aspect of it is so critical, right? That building that relationship. We've always done that. We've always connected, like, oh, you know, you have a really interesting situation. You know, this other organization, this other city, right, or this, you know, the CISO in this county over here is working on something similar. And I think they might be a few months ahead of you. Maybe we can connect you guys together so you can learn from the same lessons that they're learning. I think that relationship building thing takes people a lot further than just saying, hey, here's a tool to use, right? Or, you know, leverage this service.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Randy. That's how I started my job, Sean. I started my job here at CIS and with the MSISAC, overwhelmed by all of the resources we have for SLTTs and trying to get that out in a 30-minute or 60-minute conversation with a member where they left overwhelmed by all the things we offered as well. And it very much changed as I learned more about our members and learned more about their experience and their limitations to listening, like you said, being quiet and just saying, where are you at? Where are you starting? And then plugging in those resources from there. So it's really about being a trusted partner. And that's when I started getting phone calls from members to my personal phone even and saying, hey, I know this isn't quite cybersecurity related, but I have this weird problem happening. What can we do? And that's where our other relationships and partnerships come in, you know, very, very valuable, where we're able to then connect them to the right place to talk to. So it is about relationships. And I think that is key in cybersecurity more than most things. I don't want to upset anybody here, but, you know, having a partner, having a relationship and having people you can reach out to when you don't know what's happening is really important. And that's, you know, what I'm very proud that we offer.
Absolutely. Now, I know it was important to you, Anthony, based on, you know, obviously the work that we've done, that you've done and your team, that we really bring that to light, because it is creating, again, Randy, I love that trust that community defense model of where we're able to integrate work with one another, understand where everybody is, and really get everybody aligned. And I, you know, in some cases, it aligns to elements of the NCSR in some of the scoring that we've seen and improvement and being able to do that outreach and, you know, metrics, getting that back to see where we need to improve and constantly evolve our processes, I think is so important and something I know both of you have taken as really personal elements, as it were, to your jobs and do it so well, so effectively, you know, one, getting out there, spreading the word, two, engaging, meeting with members and making sure that they know that they're being heard, I think is incredibly important and something you both do exceptionally well. And I just think it needs to be highlighted respectfully that that's not something that you regularly see from other particular vendors or others providing services in the space, and that we just want to appreciate the work that you both do and your teams in order to actualize that and really start to get the word out and what can be done. Because in some cases, you know, where they are is lost. I have no idea where to start. I have no idea what type of services, capabilities, what threats, what exists in this environment. And being able to articulate that in such a way that one is palatable and that can be improved upon over time, it's incredible. So again, I think you both need, I wanted to call you both out there again.
Thank you.
But just great work, really great
Thank
work.
You. Thank you.
Absolutely. So Anthony, I want to go on to our last letter of our acronym. So the second T, territorial. How does that change? So 16 territories, 5 permanently inhabited. How does that change certain engagements? And I know we've had a lot of success working with Puerto Rico in this space, and it's been an opportunity as well as lessons learned. How does that fit into our overall operational profile?
Yeah, I think we've been doing a great job at engaging the territories, and I know a lot of them are using Albert or other services and finding success there. And you mentioned a good relationship with Puerto Rico. But I think the hardest operationally, you know, challenge there is distance. So, you know, we have some territories that are in several different time zones west of where most of our staff is based. So, you know, I've heard and I've been part of a lot of conversations where employees of CIS or MSISAC employees are staying up late, staying on late, or getting up very early to kind of communicate with these different folks. And then there's a sense of isolation too, right? It's really easy to communicate and collaborate and have in-person events and have in-person opportunities, you know, amongst the continental US or regionally. It's a little bit more difficult when you consider all the territories to have them have the same opportunities to engage and connect and have that partnership we just talked about, Sean. So I think that's a really important area. I think we could continue to improve in that area for sure. I know we've done a pretty good job of trying to include a lot of those folks in our MSISAC annual meeting, making sure they have an opportunity to come out and engage in person. But it's a big challenge, right? So you're flying out to Northern Mariana Islands or Guam or something, that's a hike. So we got to make sure that those folks, their needs are heard, they're included, and we're communicating with them on their time too. So I know it sounds simple, but I think it's really important.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Any thoughts there, Randy, with our territorial members?
Yeah, there's probably a couple extra nuances that with territorial that a lot of people don't think about. So the citizens are considered U.S. citizens, but the territories themselves actually have their own government structure with their own executive branches. So much like a U.S. state in a way, but they have limited autonomy when it comes to setting their own law. They're subject to U.S. law. There's some different nuances for the territory. So even though they're considered U.S. citizens, the citizens are not technically allowed to vote in U.S. federal elections. We also mentioned, and it came up a couple times, the 5 inhabited territories. We probably should name them. You guys mentioned Puerto Rico already. I heard Northern Mariana Islands. I'm not sure if did we say Guam? We might have said Guam. So that's number 3. We also have American Samoa and, of course, U.S. Virgin Islands. And what's interesting about a lot of them, too, similar to the tribal discussion that we had, a number of them, you know, because they are islands or they're out, you know, in remote areas, particularly like Northern Mariana Islands, you know, chain of islands, in Guam, they're far away. If somebody has a need it's difficult to get them somewhere. So let's say, you know, they have a 911 operations center or another, you know, some emergency communications center or a hospital or a school system that gets hit with ransomware. They can't necessarily divert patients or divert students as easily as somebody can in the continental United States, right? So those are the kinds of things that, you know, for them, it's a significant impact or at least a different impact. It's one thing if a hospital system here in the Northeast gets hit with ransomware and services are disrupted, there's another hospital within probably an hour drive in any direction, right? That's not the case when you're in the Northern Mariana Islands. It's not the case when you're in the U.S. Virgin Islands, right? So those are things that we probably take for granted, you know, living in relatively densely populated areas in the continental United States. But people who live in rural areas, whether they're in the territories or not, you know, that's a different reality that they live in. And in today's cybersecurity and threat environment, where, you know, ransomware actors don't really care if they're going. In fact, they're specifically targeting healthcare operations, right? They're not thinking about the potential impact on human lives. That's something that we need to think about. So how do we help an organization that has a different authority structure, has a different autonomy, has, you know, challenges with being very remotely isolated? How do we help them, you know?
Such a great point, Randy, and especially, Sean, when it comes to natural disasters. So especially U.S. Virgin Islands, Puerto Rico, kind of right in Hurricane Alley, if that's not a patented term, I just made it up. So we can go with that. But, you know, we've seen them struggle with infrastructure, and that all relates to cybersecurity as well, too. So it all kind of ties together. Where in the continental United States, when Hurricane Sandy or Superstorm Sandy hit the New York area, you know, we had EMS units and other power technicians coming all the way from Michigan or beyond, just driving over. They have their trucks, they got their bucket trucks, they have their tools. How do you do that with Puerto Rico if they have a major technological failure or power issue that causes some sort of issues? So, it's a logistics thing. It's a national disaster thing. Randy's absolutely right. It's a mutual aid thing. And these things need to be thought of and prepared for and have, you know, different best practices and suggestions for those unique circumstances.
Absolutely. Well, team, we've reached the 30-minute mark. Again, thank you so much. I appreciate it. I offer the appreciation, Anthony, Randy, for all the work that you're doing, the mission, and continuing really helping the SLTT community in many, many different ways. So thank you so much to you both.
Thank you. Thank you for all you do.
Can we give one more fun fact?
Absolutely, we can.
All right. So we didn't touch on the special, well, we didn't talk about special districts at all, but those typically happen at the local government under the L, right? You know, things like school districts and library districts, fire districts. And so the fun fact I want to share, which was in the presentation that you were referencing earlier, is in 1736, Benjamin Franklin himself founded the first fire district, technically the first official special district. It was the Union Fire Company of Philadelphia. So it's a nice fun fact for those in the Philly area. You can be proud of that. Ben Franklin, first special district ever, right in your hometown.
That's for your Philly trivia nights when you're out in Philly. There you go.
Yeah, that's right.
Awesome. Well, again, thank you both. And thank you to our audience. Any questions, concerns, podcast@cisecurity.org. Catch us on YouTube at The CI Security. And listen to new episodes like this and much, much more. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to the podcast today.
The thoughts and opinions expressed by our podcast guests are solely theirs and do not necessarily reflect those of CIS.
Tune in on Wednesdays for a new episode. And in the meantime, visit our website at cisecurity.org.
Together, we'll continue our efforts of creating confidence in the connected world.